I was just really exasperated by the degree to which Europeans were so reliant on America while also being scared of America, right? It reminded me of this relationship that either a child or a battered wife would have with an abusive father or husband, where each time America was really terrible to them, let's take even the recent issue with Greenland. So you have these threats by Trump to Greenland. And finally, the battered wife Europe has the nerve to start to push back a bit or think about leaving. And then the husband says, oh, no, I was just kidding. Don't worry about it. Everything's fine. And Europe, the battered wife, convinces herself that, oh, he's fine. He's changed. Everything's back to normal. And the United States right now is getting away with threatening behavior toward Europe that Europeans would never accept from anyone else.
Follow the money.
It's been the hot topic in European news and politics in the past year. The EU is too dependent on the US. From controversies around trade deals with Washington to talk of breaking free from the American cloud, Europe's reliance on the US is everywhere. But according to American-European author Dave Keating, something much deeper is at play. In his book, The Owned Continent, Dave argues that Europeans are also suffering from a psychological dependence on American culture, and as a result, stand by and watch when President Trump threatens to invade Greenland or starts bombing Iran. In this special episode of the Follow the Money podcast, we are joined by Dave Keating to talk about how this cultural dependence works in practice and how this has also led to a far greater military dependence than many of us realize. Hi, David. Thank you for joining me.
Very happy to be here. Looking forward to our discussion.
So looking at the recent developments of the US starting to bomb Iran, arguably violating international law, and most European leaders not really condemning these actions, a lot of people would argue like, okay, we don't really have a choice. We need also to stay on the US's good side with the eye on Ukraine as well. But what you write in your book is that you don't completely buy that argument. You don't think we can simply explain it by that, right?
Yeah, the purpose of writing the book was to answer a question that I kept being asked over the course of last year, which was, why are European leaders surrendering to Donald Trump over and over when he is so unpopular with their citizens? And the most common explanation that we've heard for that over the past year has been because Europe needs America to continue supporting Ukraine. They need America to defend Ukraine from Russia, and they need America to defend Europe from Russia, because after Ukraine falls, Europe will be next. And so they need to continue the American protectorate. The argument is simply that Europe depends on America militarily for its defense, and so therefore they have no choice but to do whatever Donald Trump says. But I think there's something much broader going on here, and it has to do with the psychology of Europeans. Because it isn't that European leaders are doing this while their citizens are up in arms and outraged. We really haven't heard much from European citizens on this topic. Are Europeans out demonstrating against their governments? No, we have not seen Europeans taking to the streets. And the reality is that European leaders are reflecting the popular will of their people, which is that though they don't like Donald Trump, they don't see any alternative other than American servitude. But I think this is very subconscious. I don't think they actually realize the state to which they've gotten to here. I mean, Europeans have been like a frog in boiling water over the past 80 years in accepting this constant American dominance over their lives. It's something surely they never would have accepted if America presented it all at once to them 80 years ago. But because this has developed slowly over time, Europeans have just come to accept as normal this level of American dominance over their lives and the degree to which Europeans have to do whatever America says. And that's why we haven't seen much pushback from Europeans to their leaders taking these actions. And so that's my answer to the two Europeans when they ask, why are European leaders surrendering? Well, because they're doing what their citizens have automatically expected of them.
And when did you first start observing this American dominance of the European psyche, essentially?
Well, I moved to Europe 20 years ago. I write about this in the prologue of my book, my reasons for moving to Europe. And I read a couple books about the European Union, Jeremy Rifkin's The European Dream, for instance, that was talking about the possibility of this new superpower that could challenge the United States. And so I became very interested in that. I moved to Europe in order to cover the EU, but was immediately frustrated by the degree to which ordinary Europeans were just so fixated on America, and also how much they were willing to let the United States run their lives and weren't even really thinking very critically about how much America was running their lives. So this was a frustration that was building up over many years, over 20 years. And it was really last year, the sight of Ursula von der Leyen signing that surrender deal with Donald Trump, that was what finally motivated me to write this book and kind of put to paper a lot of the thoughts I've been having over my two decades on this continent.
And when you say the huge and the vast influence of American life on European citizens' life, what are some examples of how we see that?
So there was a reason why I decided to start with this cultural dominance, because I think it's something that Europeans haven't thought of very much. But, you know, when you wake up in the morning as a European, you shut off the alarm on your American smartphone, you log into your American email administrator, you use your operating system, which is an American iOS or Microsoft, you log into American social media platforms, you order an Uber from an American company, you all day long pay with American credit cards. These are all American services that can be turned off at any moment by the United States. And this has become a big fear over the past year that with one swipe of a pen, Donald Trump could turn off the European economy. And then you think about what Europeans consume culturally. So they're dominated by American television. If you turn on the radio in Europe, you are almost certainly going to encounter an American song that varies hugely by country, as I trace in the book. Southern European countries tend to produce more of their own culture than Northern European countries. But for instance, in the Netherlands, 90% of movies that are in Dutch movie theaters come from the United States, and only about 3% of songs on Dutch radio, mainstream stations, Dutch dedicated stations, are in Dutch, which is an astounding statistic. And other than Sweden, this has been the big trend for Northern Europe and also for Eastern Europe. That has a big effect on people's lives psychologically. I mean, you can't, if you are consuming American culture, watching American movies, TV shows, listening to American music, logging onto American internet sites, all of your life, from the moment you're born, of course, that's going to have a psychological effect on you. It's kind of embedded feeling that America will always be a friend. And that's why you've seen Europeans have such difficulty over the past year accepting the reality of what is happening in the United States.
Right. Yeah, because I think that was also super eye-opening for me when I was reading your book, because of course here in the Brussels bubble, well, and also beyond that, we hear constant news about the American domination when it comes to tech and when it comes to economic dependencies. But it's quite easy for me still to think, oh, well, I love those American films that I watch. I love those American books that I read. I do not like listening to Dutch songs. I prefer American music. But are you essentially saying that I should sort of see that as a problem, the fact that I personally also experience it like that?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, there's nothing wrong on its own in watching an American TV show or listening to American song. Cultural interchange is great, right? We don't want to live in a world where we're each only listening to the music of our own country or watching the television of our own country. Then we would be North Korea. But the problem is, just like junk food, American culture is best consumed in moderation. And when it becomes the majority of your cultural diet, that's when it's a problem. And in Europe, we're not looking at a globalized situation where Europeans are consuming, are watching TV shows from all over the world. They're watching TV shows from their own country and America, maybe occasionally from other European countries, but not very often. If you look at the statistics, there are, you know, a couple breakout hits that will emerge that other European countries are watching. Let's take Casa del Papel from Spain, by the way, produced by an American company, Netflix. Borgen in Denmark. So you could think of a couple examples of European TV shows that have become successful elsewhere. But generally, when you turn on the TV in a European country, you see two types of things: American things and domestic things. Europeans aren't consuming each other's culture. So yes, watching foreign TV shows is generally good. Watching only American TV shows is generally bad.
And do you think this cultural domination by the US has always been a problem that we only see the results of right now? Or do you think it has also only become problematic because of what's happening in the US and what's happening in the White House now?
I think it was already problematic. Like I said, this was a big frustration for me for the past 20 years, whether Obama was sitting in the White House or Trump. This is a problem, but it's a problem that's emerged over time. It all started right after World War I with the American Hollywood studios moving into Europe to replace the European studios that just, for obvious reasons, couldn't produce movies in the early 1920s. They cooperated with the U.S. State Department to have a near monopoly over European movie theaters, and European movie producers really never recovered from World War I. The dominance in other areas came later. American television shows didn't really start penetrating the European market in earnest until the 1970s. And that was because of programming deals. You had more TV stations, particularly in the 1980s with the development of cable and then satellite TV. You had more stations, which needed to fill airtime with more content. And that's when the Americans were pushing over the content. It's been over time, like I say, a frog in boiling water to get us to this point that we're at. But no matter who was occupying the White House, if we as Europeans are living in a world where we are culturally dominated by the United States, that has a psychological effect that impedes our independence and sovereignty as a continent. And that's a problem.
I mean, you just said we as Europeans. Do you personally identify as a European right now?
I do. I have two EU passports now, Italy and Belgium. So out of my three passports, I am 2/3 European on paper. I've lived here for 20 years. I intend to stay here. I don't ever intend to go back to the United States because things are objectively better here. Quality of life is objectively better here. And things are more stable here than the United States.
You're mentioning that many Europeans might glorify this American dream way too much in their head. Do you ever feel like maybe it also works the other way around for you? Have you at any point thought maybe I actually glorified this European life too much?
Yeah, for sure. I came to Europe with, you know, this box of books all about how great Europe was, and it has been very difficult. I mean, when I arrived in Europe in 2007, it did not match the fantasy I had in my head. I did not find an emerging superpower here. I did not find a people who recognized themselves as a people yet. You know, it's often said about the Italian Risorgimento when Italy was created in the 1860s that Italians didn't understand themselves as Italian. They didn't know yet that they were Italian. They had to be told by Garibaldi and et cetera. Europeans don't yet know they're Europeans. And they didn't when I arrived in 2007, and they still don't today, which was disappointing. And, you know, I think actually Americans on the left, which is the bulk of my family and friends in the U.S., often describe Europe in ways that I think is a little naive. So also Americans on the left have this kind of fantasy of Europe as, oh, yeah, you when you have a baby, you have 2 years of maternity leave and you you pay absolutely nothing for school. And all of these true to an extent in that in the U.S., there is no guaranteed maternity leave. In the U.S., at a private university, it's going to cost you $50,000 a year, whereas in Europe, it'll cost you, $1,000, $2,000. But it's not completely free in most countries. Things like that. So it is the case that Americans on the left have maybe an exaggerated impression of Europe. I often describe growing up in America like being a fish in a fishbowl. Everyone is looking in at you, but you can't see out of that fishbowl. You have no idea what's going on in the rest of the world. When you grow up there, you only see movies, television from your own country. If you watch a nightly news broadcast in the US, the rest of the world is treated like another planet.
And so on the one hand, we have the Americans that you say are quite turned quite inwards, whereas you actually argue that Europeans are perhaps turned outwards a bit too much and should actually Yes. focus a bit more on themselves. The fact that they're not so much identifying as Europeans is, in your opinion, also a result of them being overly focused on the US. You don't shy away from using very stark terms in describing that relationship. You compare it to a relationship between an abusive parent and a child. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, this was a metaphor I kind of stumbled upon on my Substack last year when I was just really exasperated by the degree to which Europeans were so reliant on America while also being scared of America, right? It reminded me of this relationship that either a child or a battered wife would have with an abusive father or husband, where each time America was really terrible to them, let's take even the recent example, even though it happened after the book came out, but the issue with Greenland. So you have these threats by Trump to Greenland, and finally the battered wife Europe has the nerve to start to push back a bit or think about leaving. And then the husband says, oh, no, I was just kidding. Don't worry about it. Everything's fine. And Europe, the battered wife, convinces herself that, oh, he's fine. He's changed. Everything's back to normal. And as well with the metaphor of a child, I mean, the United States right now is getting away with threatening behavior toward Europe that Europeans would never accept from anyone else. I use the analogy of China being a kind of neighbor in this situation. So the child, if China came up to the child in the street and, you know, hit him in the face or tried to abduct him or something terrible, the child wouldn't accept it from China because China isn't the parent. China is the neighbor. And so Europe would scream and probably run to daddy, to America. But if the parent does it, if the parent is abusing the child, that's the child's whole world. The child doesn't know anything other than being taken care of by the parents. And so then the child accepts that from the parent because they're dependent on the parent in a way that they're not dependent on the neighbor. And in the book, I use the analogy of, imagine Xi Jinping did blank, 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 and I just list all of the things that Trump did last year. It would be beyond doubt that Europeans would never accept that. And the reason that they accept it from America is because there is this childlike relationship between Europe and the United States.
And so on a psychological / cultural level, what should I as a citizen do to free my own mind from this American dependence?
It's really hard because people keep asking me that, and I don't want to be like, just stop watching all American TV. I understand that's not realistic, and I wouldn't want to do that either. I think the first thing to do is just kind of do it more consciously. So when you're watching an American TV show, when you go to the movie theater and choose an American movie, just be conscious that you're doing it. Be conscious of the percentage of your cultural diet that's being made up of American things. And I think also just like when people maybe have a visceral reaction at first to their own pop music, which I hear a lot from people that when I ask them about, I really like, you know, the different national variations of European pop, particularly Italian pop, French pop, Spanish pop, Greek pop is really amazing. And I try to get Europeans into it who are not from those countries, and their instinctual reaction is, this is stupid. But I always tell them, I'm sorry, but if this was Britney Spears singing this, you'd think it was a banger. You're trained to think that American pop is cool and European pop is cringe. So I would just say the very first step is acknowledging where that reaction comes from and that maybe it's not true.
But don't you fear that this focus on sort of this reappreciation of European culture could in fact lead perhaps to more nationalism rather than promoting this European identity?
I think if we can harness the nationalism in the right way, then I'm not worried about it, because it is the case that Europeans, I think, don't have enough pride in their own cultures right now, or they've ceded too much to America. French would be the big exception, I think. But let's think about Germans. Let's think about Dutch people. I think even Italians, Greeks. You know, even the countries that do produce a good amount of music, for instance. There's not enough of a sense of pride in the culture that these, particularly the pop culture that these countries are producing. And, you know, unfortunately, we have the far right now trying to harness that in all the wrong ways. So in Italy, the far right prime minister, Giorgia Meloni, is starting this attack on the English language. So they're trying to ban English words in public discourse, in signs, in advertising. And that's completely the wrong approach. It's just stupid, self-defeating, and it's just like far-right populist nonsense. But it's true that we should take more pride in what Europeans should take more pride in what their own countries produce for culture, but should also take more pride in what European culture produces as a whole. And I know that for a lot of Europeans, this idea of being proud of being European or proud of European culture makes people a bit uncomfortable because it could feel racist. It could feel like you're embracing histories that you shouldn't be proud of. Yes, we should be aware of our history, but Europeans could stand to have more pride. And unfortunately, I think if the far right are the only ones willing to make that argument and not the center and not the left, because they do have a point.
Well, we have, of course, seen in the Netherlands, for example, with our new prime minister from a progressive party that actually really embraced the Dutch flag as well in his campaign as a progressive.
It's true. Yeah, I was actually at the D66 Party Congress where it was big. Rob Jetten's first like big stepping out. And I was speaking there about the book, actually. But I noticed a lot of Dutch flags, which kind of shocked me at first because it's not something I'm used to seeing in the Netherlands other than King's Day. Interesting. And I think, yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with displaying the flag. I think that if you hand that territory over to the far right only, you're giving them an easy win.
And you just mentioned the aspect of language, which I also found a very interesting aspect of your book, because at first glance, it does indeed seem like a bit of a contradiction that you're telling Europeans to free themselves from the US, yet embrace English as a language. Why do you think that's so important, though?
So two reasons. One is that we need to break the association between English and America, right? So yes, America is the reason why English became Europe's lingua franca, why more than half of EU citizens can now speak English. It's nothing to do with the English themselves. It's nothing to do with Britain. Okay, we can take that as a starting point and see that English was a byproduct of this cultural, economic, and military dominance. But then let's move on from there, right? So not everything that has resulted from this dominance has to be a bad thing. The fact that more than half of Europeans can all understand a single language is unprecedented in history. There was no lingua franca of the common man to the degree that we have with English now in Europe's history. And that's why I think we should embrace English and we should not associate it with America, because America had nothing to do, really, in terms of proactive action in making English the lingua franca of Europe. It really came about by accident. So I think there's no reason why embracing English should mean America.
And what I find very interesting is that you give quite a lot of practical advices on how to sort of embrace his European identity more, with English language being one of them. So, for example, I personally live a life that's quite in a European bubble, I would say. My social and professional life is in English as much as it is in Dutch. And even I noticed that, like, a certain laziness, perhaps, to really actively seek out this European identity and actually decrease my dependency on American culture. And that's for someone that lives already in a European bubble. So I'm wondering if you think about the average citizen in a European nation state, don't you fear that what you say is perhaps a bit of a mismatch between what their daily life is like? Do you think it's realistic that they could actually make this switch?
So I think that it's unrealistic to think that, let's say, Italians are going to start watching German TV shows.
Yeah, they might think you're crazy if you tell them that.
Yeah. But the reason is because they're in German. Now, what if they were in English? And this is a point I make in the book. Perhaps European producers of television and movies should think about having their TV show be in English. Now, that wouldn't always work, right? Because it would be weird if you, as a German TV show producer, if you're having a TV show about a German family, like a German sitcom, it would be weird if they were speaking English to each other. Now, when Americans do this, nobody questions it, by the way. So when an American movie producer makes a movie about Napoleon and everyone's speaking English in that movie, everyone's like, well, that's normal. But it's not normal. But if a French production company made that movie and everyone was speaking English, it would seem really weird to people, right? I question why. I don't think it should be considered so outrageous that a German production company would think about making a movie about, I don't know, Otto von Bismarck, where he's speaking English. If they really want that movie to be watched worldwide and not just in Germany, that could be a way to attract the investment to make that a big budget film that people across Europe would watch. But if you are having it in German, your audience is going to just be in Germany. If that's what Europeans are content with, fine. But what I'm outlining here in the book is the effects of that. When movie producers make those choices and they're free to make those choices, but it does have this extra effect of making the pan-European culture that we consume American, because the Americans are the ones making their music, television, and movies in English. And when it comes to music, that's the easiest one to do, obviously, and it's already happening. To an extent, I point out that in Sweden, Sweden has become this pop music powerhouse, the third biggest exporter of pop music in the world after America and Britain. And they export that music in English. Most Swedish pop music is in English, even that music where they don't expect the song to leave the borders of Sweden. It's in English. Why? Because they've understood that they have huge cultural export power by making their pop music songs in English. And I understand why people might have an emotional reaction to this or a defensive reaction to this. But I'm just asking that people think about the possibilities for changing the current dynamic. And maybe people need to let a certain amount of resistance go in order to change that situation.
Yeah, because you even believe that those cultural changes would lead to us also not simply accepting that economic and military dependency, right?
Yeah, because I really believe that the cultural dominance has led to a psychology that makes Europeans accept the economic and military dominance. They all come hand in hand. And so they all kind of therefore have to be done at the same time. And you'll never be able to reduce or extricate America's hold over this continent in the European and military spheres unless you can break the psychology of dependence that's come with the cultural dominant.
And the combination of the economic and military and cultural dependence, you even describe that as a form of cultural imperialism. You also use the term colonization by the US. Some people might argue that that sort of undermines the gravity of what that term means and what it has historically meant. What's the reason that you don't shy away from making that comparison?
Yeah, so I tried to limit the use of those two terms in the book because I do believe they're problematic and not really describing the same phenomenon as those words are really meant for. Nevertheless, I do think that it is useful in kind of waking Europeans up to the subservience that they're in. When we're talking about colonialism, we're talking about both setting up colonies in places, but also the colonial powers' culture coming to dominate the colony. That very describes what's happened with the United States. So with the United States, you had them coming in after World War II, militarily occupying Europe, keeping military occupation force here to a degree in specific countries, and then flooding the zone with their own culture, which has in turn made the people subservient to that foreign power. That sounds a lot like colonialism, right? And so though the specific circumstances may be different, and of course the brutality doesn't even, I mean, that's the brutality is really where the difference would apply, because European colonialism in Africa and Asia was and the Americas was brutal, was repressive, was violent. That's not what's happened here. America's cultural imperialism has not been violent. But that's why what we're really talking about here is cultural imperialism, cultural colonialism.
And you just mentioned military occupation. Now, a lot of people would say that there's a certain optimism right now. Look, European countries are spending more on their own defense. They are decreasing that dependency on the US. You don't seem to share that optimism yet.
No, because spending alone isn't going to do it, right? I mean, all that's happened is that European countries have agreed to a completely nonsensical and unrealistic 5% of GDP military spending target. It's a number that was plucked out of thin air by Donald Trump. It's a number that even the US doesn't reach at 3.2% of military spending. And they all agreed to it, and it means nothing. Pedro Sanchez is correct when he said everyone is kind of living a lie there at that NATO summit in June. The increase in military spending is needed. However, it's needed in a European way, and there needs to be bi-European clauses in this military spending. Otherwise, all you're doing is actually increasing the dependence on the United States if the vast majority of the spending is going toward the American military-industrial complex. If all this money is just flowing across the Atlantic, I mean, it's two problems. One is you're not benefiting the European economy with this spending. You're only benefiting the American economy. But also, you're buying American weapons that can be turned off with the flip of a switch. Not literally, but metaphorically, because these, let's say, fighter jets, they need software updates that only America can provide. And Donald Trump really gave away the game here when he said, oh, yeah, we're selling our allies in Europe military equipment that maybe won't be so good if they don't become our allies, or if they're not our allies in the future. Everyone knows this is the case, right? Every defense person in any government in Europe will deny it, but it's true. And that is a very good reason not to buy American military equipment. What we really need is to have European command and control over the military activity. So you need, ideally, a two-pillar NATO. This is a concept that's been talked about for a long time, but the United States has worked very hard to kill, most specifically when they intervened to get an effort at doing this in the EU Constitution that was being written circa 1999. The U.S. Defense Secretary stepped in and said there will not be an EU caucus in NATO. It was a command. So it's the Americans' fault that the Europeans are not able to defend themselves, first of all, because Americans, well, it's Americans and Europeans' fault, let's say, because the Europeans didn't really resist this order. But NATO remained a protectorate and not a real alliance because America blocked efforts to have a single European pillar or EU pillar within NATO that would have independent command and control and therefore capable of acting independently of the United States if it needed to. The ideal situation has always been you convert NATO into being an actual alliance between two powers, Europe and America, that will defend each other if needed. Unfortunately, we don't have that. Is it too late to preserve NATO, to have NATO be retrofitted into a real alliance? I suspect it probably is. I think NATO is about to collapse.
But in this case, it would be a bit, it wouldn't be fair to say that Europe has solidly been the victim here, right? It has also been the case that with relatively low spending on defense, we have been protected by the US as well. So would you say it has, perhaps in the pre-Trump era, was it also in Europe's interest to sort of keep it that way and that they made that choice with agency and that we can't really blame the US for that here.
Exactly. Europeans absolutely made that choice with agency. Even as successive US presidents were haranguing the Europeans about their low levels of military spending, you know, Bob Gates, the defense secretary under Barack Obama, was making, you know, the same speeches just with more diplomatic tones at NATO summits. There's a clear reason why Europeans just didn't have the motivating factor to actually do it. And that's because America would always be there. So why bother? So Europeans have absolutely participated in this. Europeans could devote the spending to developing social welfare programs and things like that rather than military spending. You can understand why they made that choice, but in hindsight, it was a very, very bad choice.
You're quite critical about the idea of NATO really being an alliance. Do you believe it was never really an alliance then?
I do believe it was never really an alliance, yes. There's a meme that has gone around the internet showing on the top all of the American bases in Europe and on the bottom, these are the European bases in America. And of course, it's empty. There are no European bases in America. There are no European troops in America. So it's hard to understand that as an equal alliance. Now, of course, that's because the expected theater of war is Europe, not America. But that just shows how much, I mean, when you have one side of this being vulnerable to attack by an aggressive neighbor, that is Europe vulnerable to attack by Russia, and one not, it really shows this isn't an equal alliance. But let's say in an alternative history that had developed, then NATO would be an alliance. NATO would have been an alliance all this time because you would have had two pillars. So I would not say that the objective of NATO was necessarily to create a protectorate by the United States. Like I really don't think this was a nefarious plot by America. You know, America understandably wanted something in return for having bailed Europe out in World War II and rode to the rescue. They didn't have to do that. They chose to do that. And given the position of strength they were in following the war, it is completely understandable why they would have wanted something in return for the Marshall Plan funding, or why they would have wanted supreme control over this NATO alliance. It's what's completely understandable is the American urge to make this a protectorate. What's not understandable is the European surrender to that urge. I mean, it's understandable to an extent because Europeans were obviously in a very weak position following World War II. But after the economic miracles of the 1950s and 1960s, I don't know what the excuse was anymore. There's lots of blame to go around, but I do think that NATO developed into a protectorate and it didn't necessarily have to be. You could have had a different NATO.
So, and when you say protectorate, what you really mean is that there's a structural power imbalance, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, having the supreme Allied commander always be American, just that just shows on its face that NATO is an American instrument. As long as there's not a European pillar, NATO is a protectorate.
And leaving all other controversies on this point aside, don't you think that speaking about a protectorate, the fact that European countries helped the US in its invasion of Afghanistan post 9/11, doesn't that counter the idea of a protectorate for you? That in fact now it was the European countries that had to help the US?
Not at all. Not at all. And I know that, you know, technically it was the Europeans' idea to trigger Article 5 for 9/11. But the reason they were doing that is clear: to ingratiate themselves to America, sucking up to America, even though it wasn't in their strategic interest to join in the Afghanistan war. That was done to kind of pay it forward so that they could later use this to America to say, but we helped you in the war. Now, Afghanistan wasn't really an Allied mission. Afghanistan was an American war in which the Europeans helped. And obviously, we can see that with the way it ended. Joe Biden took a unilateral decision without even consulting the Europeans to pull out of Afghanistan, and the Europeans were just left there flailing. And in that way, it's completely consistent with NATO being a protectorate.
And do you also see a parallel with the present-day situation in Iran?
Yeah, completely. It really seems like the lessons were not learned at all here. Obviously, the key difference is that the European countries aren't participating in the Iran war, but there's obviously huge, huge similarities. And, you know, I'm having a lot of deja vu now. It's an interesting kind of full circle moment.
Yeah. And what's the message you would really like to give to Europeans? What are your hopes for Europe?
Matt, the key message would be wake up. Because still so many in Europe do not understand what's going on here. They don't understand themselves as Europeans. They don't understand the degree that they're under American control. And I know that there is still skepticism of a European federation, that so many Europeans think, oh, that would never be possible because we're all so different and we all have different languages and hundreds of different years of history. But, you know, when Europeans have this skepticism about federation, I want to say to them, what is the alternative? How then do you propose that we as Europeans, or you as an Italian, you as a German, how are you going to have control in this new era? How are you going to protect yourself and your family? How is your country going to protect yourself and your family without European Federation, without an EU army, without having power as a bloc? And we're seeing it unfold right now with the consequences of the Iran war, with energy prices, prices for all commodities spiraling out of control. Every European is being personally hugely hurt by what's happening in Iran. And what's happening in Iran happened partly because the European leaders gave Trump positive reinforcement for all his invasions. It is because of the choices of European leaders to look the other way with that military buildup, and in the case of most of them, to support the U.S., morally support the U.S. attacking Iran. Now, for every European, it's costing you three times as much to fill your car with petrol. It's the products you buy in the grocery store are going to go up to twice the cost. We're about to be flooded with refugees from Iran. Why? Because of the choices your European leaders make. Why did your leaders make those decisions? Because you didn't stop them. So I would simply say to Europeans that you have to understand how your own thoughts, how your own psychology helped create this situation we're in. And if we want to change things, the first step is admitting you have a problem. And the second step is doing something about it.
And in the beginning of this conversation, you were talking about Europeans as we. Now you're talking about Europeans as you, which does also make me wonder if it does it happen a lot also that perhaps you get a bit of pushback in the sense that you as an American born are telling Europeans how to improve Europe. I'm wondering if that ever has that frustrated people.
It's true. I've had it pointed out to me that I use we when it's something positive and you when it's something negative. It's like the way Scottish people talk about Roger. Was it Roger Federer? No, that's the Swiss guy. One of the tennis players, I don't remember.
Andy Murray?
Yeah. Yeah. That when he would lose a game, he was British. When he would win a game, he was Scottish. I guess that's what I'm doing. But I think I flip into that when I'm like giving a message. So like you should do this, whereas we can do this or something. I don't know. But yeah, I understand the elephant in the room here, which is that, you know, the book is telling people stop listening to Americans, except this guy who's about to tell you what to do. I understand the irony of that. But you know, I like to say that I've had some book reviews of this book describing it as an outsider's perspective. That's not how I view myself. That's not how I view the book. I view the book as coming from a American European with my dual identities, someone who has the experience of growing up in the United States, but has spent the vast majority of his adult life in America, in Europe. So it's really coming from that perspective of we need to do this.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you very much, Dave. And thanks a lot for joining me.
Yeah, happy to be here.
You've listened to the podcast of Follow the Money. Our watchdog journalism is funded by our members. Subscribe and support European investigative journalism.